Welcome to Monday. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. Well, it looks like Seattle is going to get its third mayor in under a week today. City Councilmember Tim Burgess expected to be voted in by his colleagues this afternoon. Here is political analyst C.R. Douglas of Q13 News. Hi, C.R.
Hello.
Why Tim Burgess?
Well, a couple reasons. One is he's the senior member of the council, so kind of the elder statesman. He's well-respected. There's no question he's able to do the job. But I think mostly it's because he's retiring.
And we want to give it to the guy who's the least invested in city government.
Well, he's been there a long time, 10 years, so he knows what he's doing. But in effect, he's a safe choice. You know, all the other council members, the other eight, you know, are going to stick around, still active in politics. They all really want to be mayor if it comes down to it. So in a way, they all have a vested interest not supporting any of the other ones to give them this little mini benefit, if you will,
right,
that they could use in a future campaign. You know, if you were mayor for 2 months, you can use that in a future campaign. So Burgess was safe. He's leaving. He's out of politics. It was easy that way.
Yeah, Bruce Harrell would have had to give up his city council seat if he wanted to stay mayor until
absolutely.
A couple of months.
Clearly, Bruce Harrell wants to be mayor, so this wasn't an easy decision for him. He liked his 5 days in the spotlight.
Apparently, he did. He passed four executive orders?
Four or five.
Why? Well, first of all, what are the executive orders?
Well, executive orders are sort of a statement of principle, and they don't really affect policy directly, but they get the wheels moving on different things. And I think, you know, they're a little bit for show. But it was also Bruce Harrell's way of saying, you know, hey, I'm the guy for 5 days here, and I got a couple priorities, and I want to, you know, get something going on those.
There was making a bid to keep Amazon's headquarters here, find more housing for kids going through the court system.
This is kind of the biggest one, I think, of all of them, and it was an attempt to reexamine the new youth jail, you know, this big $200 million facility that's going to break ground in a year or two. That has become the new litmus test for the progressive left. I mean, are you for the jail or not? And if you're on the progressive left, you're supposed to be not for the jail. So there's a lot of movement to try and kill that project. And Bruce Harrell's executive order is in a way an attempt to kind of rethink it, say, hey, we should reexamine that. It's not a city project. It's a county project. So they don't really have the power over it anyway. But it was his way of making clear what side of the jail debate he's on. He's now basically against the youth jail, Bruce Harrell.
And a couple of executive orders about trash cleanup and the city's vulnerability to hacking. But why would an unelected 5-day mayor impose any executive orders on the city?
Well, it was his way of saying, I've got this perch for a few days and I'm going to use it. You know, if you took any one of those council members and made them mayor for 5 or 6 days, they'd all probably do an executive order or two.
But it's supposed to go through the city council unless it's an emergency, right?
Not executive orders. That's the whole point. They're an executive order and they bypass the legislature. But the point is they don't radically change things. They set the ball in motion. Listen, any mayor does dozens of executive orders over the course of even a few months' time.
Will Tim Burgess undo any of the executive orders?
I doubt it. Okay. I doubt it. They're all probably things he would support.
So he could have let Tim Burgess pass these, but he got his 5 days.
True.
Okay. Tim Burgess will only be mayor for a couple of months or so because the winner of the Jenny Durkin-Kerry Moon election is going to become mayor early at the end of November. What will Tim Burgess do in his 2 mayoral months?
Well, there's a couple things, the biggest of which is present the city budget, which he will do next week, you know, this multi-billion dollar spending blueprint. Now, that's largely been crafted. You know, Ed Murray has been working for months on that. And actually, Tim, as budget chair, has been collaborating. So there aren't going to be a lot of major differences to what would have been the Murray budget in effect. But I expect a few tweaks. You know, there'll probably be a little more money given to pre-K. You know, that big program we started a couple years ago was the baby, if you will, of Tim Burgess. He conceived that idea and pushed it. It's had a little bit of a shaky start. So I think he'll want to endow that kind of a little bit more on his way out. I think he'll probably get some money for sexual abuse victims. I think the council's now sensitive to that topic because of the allegations against Ed Murray. So expect that in the budget. And I also think a larger item will be the Soto Arena. Anyone who's a fan of that probably doesn't like that Tim Burgess is going to become mayor. He doesn't like that proposal. He would rather it be at Key Arena. Ed Murray was moving more toward the Key Arena. So I think Burgess will try in a couple months to solidify as much as possible Key Arena as the future NBA facility and not Soto.
But I'll say the same as I did about Harrell. Doesn't Burgess have a kind of obligation to not do much, given that we'll have a new mayor in a couple of months?
Yes, and I think he'll be sensitive to that. I mean, he recognizes he's in this for the interim, and largely this is about not rocking the boat. It's not about making huge policy proposals. It's not about doing a ton of new things and making all kinds of right turns, if you will. It's about keeping the city going and mostly smoothing it for the next mayor. And I would add that as a third big thing that we can expect from Tim Burgess, which is doing all he can to make the transition smooth. It's been a very rocky time at City Hall. I mean, we just have had three leaders in 5 days. By the time Burgess gets it this afternoon, we'll have another in 2 months. Making sure the city and the whole bureaucracy is not too discombobulated because of all that will be a big priority for this mayor.
You're right. This has been a rocky and such an unusual and unwanted exercise for the city of Seattle. Have we learned anything? Have you learned anything watching this weird process go forth?
Well, I think we learned how well city government actually works. Like I said, it's been a disruptive time, but everything kind of went as planned. You know, I think despite what we might have said about maybe a little bit of showcasing, I think Harrell comported himself well for 5 days in office. I mean, nothing, you know, no disaster happened. And I think now you'll have a very smooth transition with probably a unanimous vote or close to it for Burgess. So the city was ready for this, if you will. There was sort of a preparedness.
There was concern. Remember, the four former mayors said, we don't want Murray stepping down. It's too chaotic.
Yeah, and I think we realized it's not as chaotic as we thought. Now, I don't want to underestimate that there's been, you know, under the radar a lot going on at City Hall that's made it tricky. But we see that this has worked. I think in the long run, what we'll learn from all this goes to the sexual abuse allegations, and that there was probably insufficient attention and appreciation for the allegations when they first came forward from those victims. Obviously, Ed Murray denounced them, criticized them very strongly, and really did up until the end. So there's going to be a new appreciation for victims and their stories. And I think that maybe will be the lasting impact of the Ed Murray years and how the Ed Murray years ended.
Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas. Looks like we'll have a new mayor today. CR, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
You know, every new Seattle mayor we get inherits a city that's a little bigger than the one the last mayor had. That's because our city's growing by about 1,000 people a week, I've heard. In a moment, you're going to meet some of those newcomers, and we will ask you, what did you expect Seattle would be like, and what are you finding the Seattle area is actually like? And we're taking your phone call. We're opening up the phone, so here's the number, 206-543-5869. How has the Puget Sound area lived up to or defied your expectations? Give us a call right now, 206-543-KUOW. We are on Twitter, at KUOW, talking newcomers with Monica Guzman next. It's KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. You know, if you just moved here in like July, I hope yesterday's rain wasn't a shock. You knew it rains here, right? Well, what has surprised you about the Puget Sound area? That's our next segment now. We're adding 80,000 newcomers a year region-wide, and I want to know, what did you expect life to be like here, and what has taken you by surprise? Our phone lines are now open, 206-543-5869, taking your call, 206-543-KUOW. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. My guest is former newcomer, weren't we all? Monica Guzman, good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
The
co-founder, always a fun topic.
Always fun, Monica. You co-founded the Evergrey, the Seattle newsletter, which I read virtually every day.
Right.
So well done. And you've been doing this, or have wrapped up an ongoing series asking newcomers what they think of Seattle. Why did you even do that?
Well, right now is just such a crazy time for the city. We're constantly talking about who we are, who's here, who's coming, who's going, what's changing, how are we growing. So the last year has just been this chaotic sort of instability, but also this electricity and energy. And there's so many new people coming in. They're going to have to get used to the place and sort of integrate. And there's this tension between people who are new and people who've been here a long time, defining a lot of our politics. So it just feels like the right thing to talk about, and a very important one.
I agree. And I just, a moment ago, I said we're taking your phone calls, 206-543-5869. I want you to model this behavior of what listeners are about to call in about, Monica. What surprised you most when you came here?
So I came here in just the very beginning of 2007. And at that point, I had grown up in the Northeast, New England, a very sort of achievement-oriented culture. And I couldn't believe how many people I met here who didn't need other people's permission to just try stuff and do things. And I got so hooked on that sort of just creative free-for-all that Seattle really embraces and that I think is very characteristic of the city. And that's one of the big reasons I stayed.
Do you think that has changed in the 10 years since you've been here?
I mean, it kind of depends on who you ask. There's some conversations these days about the arts community and whether some types of creatives can even afford to live here anymore. But on the other hand, the technology industry is booming. There's a lot of jobs. There's a lot of really smart people coming in with new ideas. So it's really how you balance it all.
Speaking of artists, I understand Kay, our first caller, Kay in Fremont, you moved here for the art scene 5 years ago?
Yeah, I moved here for arts and music, and I really like all of your points, Monica, of why you stayed, because I totally feel that no one needs permission. I, you know, started a tape label, which is crazy. People still think that's weird. but I just did it, and we've put out a lot of things, and I'm helping my friends put out their music. But my only complaint is the tech boom people that are coming into our city. I feel like they're not supporting us, and they're not taking the time to seek out these things, because maybe that's not their interest, and that's okay.
How so, Kay? What makes you think that the tech workers are not supportive of the arts?
Yeah, not all of them. I don't want to put everyone in a category.
Yeah.
But I feel like a lot of the times you go out on the weekend, there's not those type of tech guys or tech girls like at a show or like supporting an art show or something. Like they're just like at bars.
Yeah, I think this is a pretty fascinating conversation. I've heard it said before that recently, and again, who knows, right, that there seems to be a kind of divide between sort of tech creativity and a more sort of artistic creativity. And maybe it's an economic one, or it's sort of based on where we all feel like the growth is really coming from and whose interests are kind of driving the city. So I hear you on that. I think that's a really interesting thing to watch.
Well, what do you mean by tech creativity? Because I don't know of a time ever when most workers were artists. It was just, there were artists and then there are people who worked in an office or worked for Boeing. And so what's different? Why does it matter that there is what you call tech creativity here, Monica?
Well, I think that, exactly. I mean, I don't even know that I could define those two different groups.
Mm-hmm.
It was a conversation I had on Facebook that became one of those epic threads, you know, a couple weeks ago, where people were just basically talking about what we just heard from our listener. Seattle is a great place to build community, and artists have had a lot of success. Like she said, you know, I get my friends, you know, to support my art. And so that's been a really good way that art can really thrive. And so the question is, all right, but if artists are finding it, you know, less easy to be able to live here, if they have to go into the suburbs, but more tech-driven people are in the core, then how do the arts still have a home here? And I think there's plenty of positive answers to that. It's a question that's driving some anxiety.
Kay in Fremont, do you have a positive answer for that? You said you came here, you were surprised by the lack of support for the arts among the tech community. What do you do with that?
I mean, I really would just say, like, if I could speak to the tech people as a whole, just, you know, you came here, and I mean, you maybe not necessarily wanted to move to Seattle, but this is the place where your job has taken you. Just look around your community. Just remember, like, where you came from and how you grew up in a place that supported other people. Because there's, I mean, it's not just Seattle. Everywhere has, like, a nice, you know, arts community where people support each other. You just need the support of a bigger community to, you know, thrive. Just people who wouldn't normally be there.
Kay, thanks for calling us. We're taking your phone call about what you expected the Puget Sound area to be like before you came and what you've actually found it to be. Are you a newcomer here and how's it hitting you? Our phone number, 206-543-5869. Again, 206-543-KUOW. We're with Monica Guzman, who's the co-founder of the Evergrey newsletter. And we have a call from Tabby in Rainier Beach. Tabby, you came from New Orleans?
I did. I moved from New Orleans about 8 years ago now.
And what did you expect and what have you found?
So I expected kind of a more standoffish people coming from a very group of people who are very social. And so I expected it to be harder to make friends. And I expected way less diversity than where I was coming from. And I was pleasantly surprised that we probably made more friends here than we've made anywhere else our entire life. We're really into, I was hearing the arts comment earlier, we're really into music. So there's a very strong music community here that we found and just are family with. And then Rainier Beach is beautifully diverse, and so that was really a happy thing to find.
Yeah, this is a big conversation about whether Seattle is very white, is it very rich, mm-hmm. is it diverse anymore? Stay on the line, Tabby, but I want to get Monica's reaction to that. I know you've had people telling you about this.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Some of our newcomers in the series that we did who are of color definitely said that, yeah, Seattle's white. Seattle's a pretty white place. But we just learned from census data reported on by Gene Balk at the Seattle Times that we're actually just slightly less white. We're slightly less white. In just 1 year, we kind of did this turn. Mm-hmm. And it's really interesting. A lot of our growth is people of color. So is it enough to signal sort of a new shift? Who knows? But it's definitely a conversation.
Tabby, the first thing you said was about how you expected standoffish and you didn't get it, because we talk even here about there being a Seattle freeze. You've not found that? Tell us.
I did not find that at all. All of my neighbors came and introduced themselves when I moved into my house within that week. And then I should give credit to our music community, because our music community is so amazing that they just adopted my husband and I, and now my family.
Well, how did you hook up with them?
Like,
and
we
you showed up, and all of a sudden your music community is there. How did you plug in?
We just went to live music,
yeah,
and just standing outside after shows or in between sets, and just started talking to people because we're very social.
Is that a New Orleans thing?
It's definitely a New Orleans thing, yeah.
Yeah, I've definitely heard that the best antidote to the Seattle freeze is to be intentional. Seattle is a warm and welcoming community kind of town if you go out and seek those communities. It's difficult when you expect them to come to you, because we are. We're just a city of neighborhoods. We're a city of these close communities. So if you're really intentional about going out and finding the things that you want to be sort of the family with, then usually you can. So it's nice to hear that.
Yeah, but what if I'd rather do nothing and complain? Have you thought about that?
Believe it or not, there's a community for that too.
Tabby in Rainier Beach, thanks for your call.
Thank you. You guys have a good day.
You too. Welcome. Welcome from New Orleans. We're talking to newcomers, and there are a lot of them. 80,000 a year in the Puget Sound area, I've heard. Our phone number is 206-543-5869, 543-KUOW. Monica Guzman is co-founder of The Evergrey, and I got to get to what I mentioned at the very beginning, because our Twitter feed is full of reaction to the rain. I'm sure you're hearing about that from newcomers on your series.
Oh, yes. It never gets old, especially now. We just had on Sunday, get this, in 3 hours on Sunday, we got 5 times more rain than July and August and the first half of September combined. So that was a nice, but the funny thing is, right, depends on how you feel about the rain. If it's just the worst, then that was a bad day. But if you're me, I've been here 10 years, and sometime around year 7, I really learned to see the return of rain as sort of a comfortable homecoming. This is the city I know and love. This is the city that welcomes me to be, like, invites me to be cozy and comfortable. It's the city of indoor spaces and of coffee shops, and it is Seattle, right? So it just...
Wow, you have drunk the rain-flavored Kool-Aid.
I really have. And trust me, when I first got here, the rain was the worst.
Yeah.
It was the worst. And now it just feels great.
I was surprised, not by the rain. I knew that when this was, gosh, how long have I been here? 35 years or something like that. But I was surprised by the etiquette of talking about the rain. I find that people who care a lot, whether it's sunny or rainy, seem to feel insulted when someone expresses a differing opinion. You know, like the rain lovers don't want to hear the rain complainers.
Yeah.
And if you are bummed out, if you love the rain, then You know what I mean? If you're bummed out, then you resent people celebrating the rain. I don't know if that's right, but I get that sense that people have their backs up.
Oh, they certainly do. And there's we asked people, you know, what does it take to become a local? And one of my favorite answers was, well, when you go ahead and do things in the rain that people would wait to do another day, like go out and grill or have a party anyway and that kind of thing. And there's some truth to that, right? That you kind of have to be in the okay with rain club to even put up with this place.
Yes, the okay with rain club. Umbrella, no umbrella, Monica?
No umbrella.
No umbrella.
Mostly because, I mean, they're unwieldy, right? Like you walk in a crowded street, you're going to annoy people really quickly.
See, that makes total sense to me. That makes me a local, I think. And now you too.
Mm-hmm.
We're asking you about your experience, 206-543-KUOW. Brian in Bellevue moved here a year ago from Missouri. Brian, what surprised you?
When I first got here, I got here May 1st of last year, and there was no rain. I was promised all this rain. Mm-hmm. And I got here and there was no rain. And they said, don't worry, it's coming. And then, you know, finally September hits and then it's just constant. And it's wonderful. I love it.
So. You love it. So far, so good. A year ago from Missouri. Anything else surprise you about being here in Bellevue and Puget Sound?
Yeah. The amount of work that's here in Seattle, it's so vastly different from the Midwest. And the people that you work with even, it's the mindset of it is just so vastly different.
Well, Brian, you thought there would be less work. Why did you come here?
I came here for a girl and we broke up 3 months after I got here.
Oh, no.
Wow. And you're still liking it?
She moved back, actually, and I'm staying here. I love it here.
Oh.
Why did she move back? It's not you, obviously. It's something about the Puget Sound region.
She moved home. She moved back. She was offered a job here. I didn't have a job when I first moved here.
Bold.
And so I just made a leap of faith. But I'm staying. I love it here.
And your work, you're a plumber, I see.
Yeah. Yes, I work for United Plumbing. One of our projects is 50th and University, so not too far from you.
Nope, not at all.
And I found a great company to work for, and there's just so much work out there.
Well, glad you're here. Thanks for plumbing us. Thank you, Brian. We're with Monica Guzman from the Evergrey and taking your calls about what surprised you about being a newcomer here. 543-KUOW, Ruby is in Brighton. Hi, Ruby.
Hi.
What's surprising?
Well, you know, we moved here about 3 years ago from Los Angeles, and we were so excited because Seattle is supposed to be so diverse, especially our zip code, 98118. And we just have found it to be so segregated.
Yes.
And that really has surprised us.
Yeah. And the segregation, it's interesting. Sometimes I hear Seattle is white and I think, are you just hyper aware? It is relatively white for a big, for a major city.
We're the fifth whitest.
Yeah. But it also sometimes means you're hyper aware of it or surprised by it or that you are in a segregated, you're walking in certain circles. What's been your experience with segregation, Ruby?
Well, I think the different, you know, the communities, you've got South Park and White Center, which are primarily Latino. You have Brighton, which is, well, used to be primarily African-American, but now it's changing.
That's Rainier Valley area, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just south of Hillman City, Columbia
mm-hmm.
City.
Mm-hmm.
So segregation is huge. I mean, the segregation is really apparent. You know, up north you have primarily the, you know, wealthy white people.
And what do you do with that?
So,
what do you do about it?
I don't, gosh. What do you do?
Well, I'm glad you're here, Ruby. Thanks for calling. KUOW, 543-KUOW, we have a tweet from Frank who says, what surprises me? 6 years ago, nobody honked their horns. Today, I hear people honking in traffic a lot. all caps. Not as bad as East Coast, but ...
I am not surprised at all by that.
Yeah?
Oh, yeah. I, the 2015 through 2016, I lived in Boston, and I came back, and just from those 10 months away, the change in traffic, I had to add 10 minutes to my expectation about getting, you know, from one place of the city and the other, and just, oh my gosh, yeah, it's so much more frustrating. You're just sitting there so much longer, just in a year.
I am a fan, though, of the informational honk. I just want to say, the honk might be road rage, or it might be, you know, hey, a lot of us want to get through this this left turn arrow, so you might want to get on the stick for the whole team.
But it's not Seattle nice.
Yeah.
It's got to be nice.
I choose to interpret it as nice. I think I say thank you when people honk. I assume they're complimenting
it's
me.
It's candid.
It's weird. I'm weird that way.
That's a fair point.
What has surprised you, newcomer? We're devoting this segment to newcomers with Monica Guzman. Peter, you moved here a year ago? You're in South Lake Union?
Yeah, I'm working in South Lake Union, living in West Seattle.
What are you doing in South Lake Union, might I wonder?
I'm the new dean of the Northeastern University campus here in Seattle.
Northeastern University campus in Seattle? I don't know about that.
Well, I'm glad that everyone knows about it now. Yeah.
So why did you come here? Just for that job?
No, I actually was working as a consultant when we came here. Came here because my business was portable. Our son went off to university, the youngest of our three, and we shopped cities. And we almost went to New Haven, Connecticut, and almost went to Philadelphia. And Seattle was number one, and we picked up and moved.
And what surprised you?
I'd say the bad stuff is less bad from a global perspective. So traffic is definitely worse. Housing is definitely more expensive. But if you compare to what are now the peer cities, it's not as bad. I mean, it's nice to have a 10-minute longer commute. But, you know, coming from L.A., a 40-minute longer commute was the increment of change. And, boy, prices are going up even in the last year. But the same house is still so much more expensive in San Francisco or New York or London. And it seems to me, as a new Seattleite, that's the peer group. And that's both good and bad.
Yeah, that's good perspective. Peter, welcome to the Northeast University campus in the Northwest. And thanks for calling.
Thank you, guys.
Monica, do you hear that from your newcomers that you've been talking to, reminders from people who know what it's like someplace else?
Yeah, it's what's nice, actually, about interacting with more newcomers is a reminder that Seattle is obviously not the only city, right? And that there's a lot of other cities experiencing change and a lot bigger cities with bigger problems and different kinds of problems. It is difficult to escape the we are the fastest growing city in America thing,
yeah,
right? Because that's gonna shake you up no matter what. No matter what the raw numbers is, it's that delta, it's that change that sort of is scary. But I think the perspective is really, really valuable to hear.
Indeed. And finally, let's welcome Simon in West Seattle. What surprised you, Simon?
I would say coming from New York City, which is such an... Any experience you have in New York City is the New York experience. There are so many people there. It's very much... sort of a behemoth that you can't really acknowledge or it will consume you. I think having lived here for a while now, Seattle is a place that is kind of obsessed with defining itself because it is changing so fast.
Obsessed with defining ourselves. Mm-hmm. How do you notice that?
Well, a lot of the friends I've made here are people who are from Washington and have moved not that far, like, and see the change happening so quickly that I think they are very focused on wanting to hold on to the past. And I appreciate that. I understand that. And because the way that things are moving so quickly here, I think it's almost impossible to really define this place until maybe things settle down a little bit. Mm.
Well, Simon, you've helped make us feel ill-defined and unsettled, but I'm still glad you're here. Thank you for calling.
Of course.
Monica Guzman, I wonder, we're talking about newcomers and how much change there's been here, and just you and I were talking about in the last week or two, there's been change. I wonder how newcomers are reacting to Amazon might have a headquarters somewhere else, mm-hmm. and who's the mayor going to be?
Who is the mayor right now is such an interesting question. I mean, if you haven't, you know, if you've just not looked at the news for 2 days, you may not know the answer. It's amazing degree of instability in this city right now. But at the same time, instability is, you know, what you need to change and to grow. It's particularly acute, and I think it's a sort of opportunity for people to get even, you know, if they're anxious, get more anxious. But if they're excited, to get even more excited, be more optimistic of where we might end up. And I think it's also absolutely an opportunity for both, you know, city leaders, once they sort of figure out who that is, but also just the community of Seattleites to take stock of what we can do to define our city ourselves and come together and do it. And it's such an interesting time for that, even nationally. People are kind of waking up to their power as citizens for all these reasons. So, you know, there's a lot of shakeups and a lot of movement, but a ton of opportunity for people to sort of take the reins.
Monica Guzman, her newsletter, The Evergrey, could arrive in your inbox, and her website, TheEvergrey.com.
TheEvergrey.com, all E's.
All E's in there. yeah, it's getting a little gray around here these days. Monica, it's great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on the program, a new Seattle startup. We were talking about the prices around here. A new Seattle startup will help pay for your down payment if you'll just agree to become an Airbnb host. That's coming up. It's The Record on KUOW, 94.9 Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. We were just talking about being surprised at, among other things, the prices around here. People want a way to affordably live in the city, wherever they want to be. And here comes a new startup company to help, as long as you'll promise to share your home with a stranger. Reporter Monica Nicholsberg wrote about this for GeekWire.com. Monica, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
So I want a house, I could use a little money to afford it, and this company will agree to do what? What's the arrangement?
They will help you out with your down payment. They can do about $20,000 per bedroom that you're willing to rent out on Airbnb after you buy your house. So that's in Seattle where they're first launching. So if I want to buy a house and I don't have the money up front, they'll give it to me and I sign a contract with them that agrees to rent out either a bedroom or a mother-in-law for a period between about 12 to 36 months and then share the profits with them. Like they might take back 70% and I get to keep 30% of the money I make from that Airbnb.
The company is called Loftium, which sounds like a pharmaceutical. Is this because prices have gotten lofty or something?
Maybe lofty ambitions of homeownership.
Ah, yeah, now I get it. So we agree that I'm going to get some down payment help and I'll rent my place out or a bedroom in the place and I give most of the money to Loftium. What if nobody wants to rent my new Airbnb? I still have to pay the money back?
You don't. So it's not structured as a loan. That's what makes it kind of different and interesting and made it hard for them to get regulatory approval, or it took time at least for them to explain this new process. But basically they're assuming the risk. You enter into this agreement, which says I'm going to give you a percentage of the profits for this amount of time, and they use their technology to predict how well the Airbnb is going to perform. But if their prediction's off, if it underperforms, you're not on the hook for any amount of money rather than just like a portion of what you've already agreed to offer.
I don't know what this says about me that this is even occurring to me, but why wouldn't someone take Loftium's money for the down payment and then I make my Airbnb so unattractive that no stranger wants to live with me?
I think that they have accounted for that. There are certain standards like, you know, upkeep and maintenance that you need to abide by as part of your contract with them.
Okay.
But it's a good idea. It's kind of an evil genius.
You like where I'm going with that. Thanks. So you wrote that Loftium was sort of flying below the radar because you said regulatory approval is an issue. Is it totally legal by now?
It's totally legal by now, but it did take, you know, we started chatting with them back in March, but they weren't really able to talk publicly about it until now because they've finally gotten approval from the federal government, which, you know, mortgage lending requires a lot more regulatory hurdles to jump through if you're going to do something innovative in that space, because we all saw what happened in 2008.
Yeah. Is this business model at risk from the Seattle proposal to tax Airbnb hosts?
It's a good question. And when I chatted with the co-founders, they said that they weren't totally worried about it. They had some different ideas about the best way to tax Airbnb hosts. And I know that they know that the city is trying to regulate this to ensure that there's still a good supply of housing on the market for long-term residents. But they don't think that it's going to significantly impact their business.
Here's something else that occurs to me about a business like this, Monica. Right now, Airbnb hosts are people who decide on their own to share their personal space. It's still voluntary here, but this arrangement seems to financially entice people who maybe otherwise wouldn't be Airbnb enthusiasts, and maybe they're more likely to not like this very the sharing their personal space. Do you know what I'm getting at?
I totally know what you're getting at. I don't think it's for everybody, and I think if you're going to do it, you have to go through those same considerations that you would if you were to Airbnb your place, regardless of getting any down payment assistance.
Right,
you know,
right.
Really thinking about, am I comfortable having somebody in my home? But I did speak with one of the first Loftium customers, a gal named Laura, who's super excited about it. She just bought a 2-bedroom house in Capitol Hill with money from Loftium. And what was really important to her was to have whoever stays in the Airbnb to be in a separate unit. So she only looked at homes with like a mother-in-law kind of space, just because she wanted to be able to go about her daily life and not be impacted by having somebody like right in the bedroom next door.
Was she shopping for a house and already thinking about Airbnbs? How did she hook up with this brand new startup?
She was friends with somebody on the Loftium team. So that's how she got in early, because like I said, they weren't talking about it publicly.
Yes. Okay. Do you think you would do something like that? This is not an ad for this company, by the way. I don't know if it's wonderful or awful or in between, but I was intrigued by the business model. Is this something you think you could see yourself doing?
It's possible. My boyfriend and I have talked about Airbnb being our place before, and I actually bought the condo that I live in now using a down payment assistance program from the state of Washington. They have these different programs that can help you out if you're a first-time home buyer. So it was totally on my radar, and I think that, yeah, like I said, like you just said, this isn't an ad for Loftium, but I do think that there's a lot of upside to owning versus renting your home, because your money is going toward equity and it's a better, you know, financial choice long term than just sort of throwing it out in the ether. So I think that I would consider it.
Finally, is this one of those disruptor companies that might get legally challenged or embroiled in reaction to this business model? We've already seen frustration with Airbnb, and, you know, Uber's a disruptor and that hasn't gone smoothly. What's your take?
Well, I think that this company has made a real effort from the beginning to work with regulators to make sure that what they're doing is legal. And I think the other thing they're really trying to think about is being a model for improving housing affordability, for getting people into their first homes. And it's not really that same scenario where a developer is buying a whole apartment building and turning every unit in it into Airbnbs when they could have been rentals. It's a situation where a long-term Seattle resident is buying a home for them to live in as their primary residence. And then if they rent out a portion of that on Airbnb, it's not like it would be housing stock that would otherwise be converted into long-term housing.
Yeah. I'm interested in this Seattle area home prices meets technology. Strangers meet each other. It's intriguing. Thanks for writing about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me on the show.
This is Monica Nicholsberg, writer for GeekWire.com, telling you about this company that helps home buyers with a down payment, and they rent out part of their home on Airbnb and share profits with that company. This is Loftium, and they officially launch in Seattle today. We'll share Monica's story with you right now from GeekWire on Twitter. So join us at KUOW. Thanks again, Monica.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to KUOW. Alex Blum dreamed all his life of joining the elite Army Rangers, and he did just before he turned 19. Then, 4 months later, right before his first deployment to Iraq, he and some friends robbed a Bank of America in Tacoma. That surprising reversal from military man to criminal got his cousin Ben Blum curious about what happened on that day in 2006. So curious, he wrote a book about it. It's called Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. Ben Blum spoke with KUOW's Jeannie Yandel.
It was a takeover-style robbery. There were four guys inside the bank, two of them with AK-47s, two of them with pistols. Alex was the driver. And he was arrested shortly afterward, to the utter shock and horror of our entire extended family. I spent the next 7 years or so trying to figure out how this guy that I'd known as a goody-two-shoes growing up, a very patriotic, idealistic kid, had gotten involved in something so utterly uncharacteristic, ending his lifelong dream in a flash. So Ranger Games is the story of trying to figure that out, and it took a lot of twists and turns along the way.
When you first decided you wanted to look deeper into what your cousin Alex did, what did you expect to find?
Well, the story that he first told us was that the Rangers, their job is to take down buildings, small facilities, and they, in order to practice those skills, would constantly run little thought experiments around Tacoma. They'd go into a Dairy Queen, they'd ask, you know, where are we, where's our infill? Where are we going to be entering this facility through? What are the red zones, places where we might be coming under enemy fire? And the plans for the bank robbery appeared to him as just another training exercise. So he told us that right up until the moment of the crime, he thought he was just engaged in the further process of gaining the skills he needed to survive in Iraq right before his first deployment. So when I first went into the project, I really thought of it as an effort to clear my cousin's name. I felt that he had been duped and manipulated by a charismatic superior, Specialist Summer, into participating in this crime, and that he had served prison time unfairly.
Well, you talked with the ringleader, this charismatic Luke Summer. What did you learn from him? What were those conversations like?
So Summer had a very different take on the robbery. He, after the robbery, claimed that he had staged the whole thing to gain a platform to protest war crimes that he'd witnessed in Iraq and Afghanistan. After that, he became involved in a whole host of other crimes, including trying to put a hit out on his own prosecutor. By the time that I began talking to him, he was medicated for bipolar disorder and told me that he'd completely transformed, that he now saw that what he'd done was crazy and he was a different person. And according to him, he had not manipulated Alex. Alex had willingly gotten involved in this plan, knowing that it was indeed a real bank robbery, and that was it. End of story. But Summer is notorious for making up stories. And in talking to him, I began to understand that he was certainly making up a lot of what he was telling me about. He claimed to have been a super hacker as a teenager. He'd written this whole memoir about his teenage super hacker career that increasingly seemed to be made up. And there were numerous other inconsistencies in what he was saying. So I had to weigh these two, in some ways, equally implausible stories against each other, one from my cousin and one from Summer.
Why wasn't it enough to just listen to the story that your cousin Alex had to tell about that robbery and have that be enough?
Right. In the beginning, that was my approach. I felt that my role was to support this guy that I knew and loved and that had suffered enormously for this crime. It ended his career and his dream and his relationship with the girlfriend he wanted to marry. I mean, it was a huge disruption. And I also believed him. He was telling what sounded to me like the truth, and very earnestly. He was really looking inside himself, trying to understand how this could have happened and what the nature of his role really was. So that was my approach for the first 2 years or so. But as I continued to gather evidence from other places, I started coming across more and more hints that there might have been another story lying beneath the one that Alex was telling me. I wasn't sure whether it was buried beneath all the trauma and just inaccessible to him, like, you know, memory is notoriously unreliable when it comes to traumatic events, or whether there was something more willful going on. But Summer seemed to be my best chance of getting another glimpse at the nature of the relationship between him and Alex. It's really within that kind of deeply complex nuance of their relationship that the truth lies about how Alex came to be involved.
And I want to talk a little bit about what you did with those two conflicting stories that you had, but I want to get a little bit into that idea of trauma that you just brought up. From my reading of the book, it seems like Alex was pretty traumatized by his training to become a ranger, and that helped, if nothing else, kind of connect him better with Luke Summer. Is that right?
The training these guys go through is pretty extreme. That was what got me interested in Alex's story in the first place. He wrote an account of his training and of the Ranger Indoctrination Program, which isn't so much a training course as a selection process, that stunned me, both with its reflectiveness and with the extremity of what he'd gone through. So I was immediately sympathetic to the idea that he had undergone a radical change in personality after going through this radical training. It's an initiation ritual. It's designed to help soldiers cohere with each other and to separate them from the world that they came from before.
Well, only fairly recently, the Army changed the name of the program from the Ranger Indoctrination Program to something else. That word indoctrination is significant.
It is, yeah, yeah. And it's a somewhat alarming word, you know? You can understand why they changed it. I would hesitate to call it trauma entirely, what he went through. I want to perhaps reserve that word for what soldiers who deploy and are diagnosed with PTSD are suffering from. But there's no question that that experience changed him radically and opened him to the possibility of a deeply trusting, loyal relationship with superiors, with any superior, anyone who fit the template of the guys he was taught to respect and follow when he went through that process, and Summer fit the bill. But at the same time, you know, I think as civilians, we are so hesitant to step outside the trauma paradigm in understanding what soldiers go through. And that ended up being a real limitation in how I approached Alex's story. I think I was very hesitant to try to hold him accountable in any way for parts of what he did wrong that he didn't seem to be fully grappling with. And I thought I was doing him a service by supporting him entirely in his version rather than challenging him. But in the end, I think I was holding him back from growing beyond it.
I'm talking with Ben Blum. He's the author of the book Ranger Games. It's an examination of a bank robbery that happened in South Tacoma in 2006. Ben's cousin Alex was involved in the robbery. Ben, you have these two conflicting stories about what that robbery was, about why and how it happened. And you set out to clear your cousin's name, but you ended up going back and challenging Alex on the places where his story didn't match up. Why?
I came to see the story that Alex had been telling for so long of his involvement as a kind of a cage that he had built for himself. It was such a radical breach in his sense of who he was to suddenly be a convicted violent felon and bank robber that he struggled terribly to figure out how to incorporate the story into his life story. And he arrived at a way of telling it that kind of worked or worked for a time. But I just, year after year, saw him retreat further and further into himself, saw him grow more and more embittered and resentful. And I came to see that as coming from the mismatch between this story that he'd been telling for so long and the more nuanced reality of what happened. I saw him kind of trapped by his inability to really own what he had done. So I came to view it as my duty, as someone close to him, as someone who loved him, to challenge him. It was one of the scariest things I've ever done, but it ended up being kind of transformational for both of us.
When you think about how scary it was to have to confront Alex with some of those holes, some of those untruths, I mean, what were those conversations like? I am imagining having uncomfortable conversations with my own family. I don't envy you.
I think it's something that everyone experiences in one way or another. You know, someone in our family like gets in a drunk driving accident or loses their job after an incident at work or, you know, any number of things that end up hurting the person who did wrong worse than anyone else. And it's someone you love, you want to help them, you want to support them. How do you support them while at the same time recognizing that they screwed up and they have something to learn from? And you know, there's this Buddhist notion that my father, a practicing Buddhist, taught me years ago of idiot compassion, which just means basically enabling, providing unconditional love and approval for any form of behavior or neurotic impulse. And I just came to view what I had been practicing with Alex as a kind of idiot compassion.
I have to ask, why publish this? This sounds in many ways like a very intimate thing that you went through with Alex, and in some ways with Luke Sommer too. Why write a book about it? Why publish it?
It's a fair question. I think Alex's story is, in the end, a tribute to his courage and to our family's love for one another, as we all grappled very imperfectly with this terribly traumatic event. I did at many times in this process consider abandoning the book and dropping the project. I came very close to doing so, and probably would have if in the end I felt it didn't reflect the deep goodness that I saw at the core of Alex's character. I always saw the possibility of real goodness in him and felt so much goodness at every point in our journey. So, you know, I expect it to be disruptive and painful for a number of the people who are involved in it. And I am sorry for that pain, but I think it's a story worth telling. And I think in the end, our family can be proud of having wrestled as honestly and as we could with this like terrible event.
In the beginning of the book, you write really beautifully about sitting down with your uncle, with Alex's dad, and having lunch. I kept thinking about how he might react while reading this book. How does the rest of your family feel about this book?
Yeah. They've been incredibly supportive. My uncle Norm, I love him dearly. he actually just read it for the first time yesterday and had some very beautiful things to say about it. He felt that it had honored him and Alex and their bond. So I was nervous about that, but so far, so good. I have gained an enormous appreciation over the course of working on this book for our aspects of our family culture that were not apparent to me growing up. You know, I thought these were all hard-ass jocks with no hearts, but that's not the case. There's an amazing amount of openness and warmth that I've discovered in our family that I didn't know existed before.
One of the things that struck me about your experience of Alex's story and trying to figure out what actually happened versus how Alex told the story of what happened was just this idea of the stories we tell ourselves about the things we do, how we sometimes spin things. How do you think about the stories you tell yourself now?
Yeah.
The decisions you make, the things you do, the way you talk about yourself to other people?
I feel a lot humbler than I used to. I think it's part of getting older too. You start to recognize that, you know, the story you had about yourself when you were 25 completely fell apart, and the story you have about yourself now, it's probably going to fall apart too. You know, why should it be any different? But I've also gained a real appreciation for the way we kind of build ourselves from the rubble of the old stories that fell apart around us, like that the enormous value that there is in applying stories to reality. Reality is always too complicated to summarize in a story, but story is just the way that the brain has to get a grip on it. And you have to keep coming up with them. You have to keep making stories. So I love making stories, and I love learning other people's stories. And when a story shatters, it's just an opportunity for a new and better one to grow.
That's Ben Blum talking with Jeannie Yandel. He's the author of Ranger Games, a story of soldiers, family, and an inexplicable crime. The book tells the story of his cousin, who was an Army Ranger, who became a bank robber. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. Hey, are you watching the new Ken Burns documentary about the Vietnam War? It just started on PBS. It is a great time to download KUOW's new podcast about the Vietnamese-American experience. It's called Second Wave, and our host, Tan Tan, uncovers how a war that ended decades ago is still affecting us. Tan Tan is going to be my guest tomorrow on KUOW. I hope you'll join us in the noon hour.